Hello, everyone. Welcome to Better Health While Aging, a podcast that gives you strategies and information about improving the health and well-being of older adults. We discuss common health problems that affect people over age 60, the best ways to prevent and manage those problems, and we also often address common concerns and dilemmas that come up with aging parents and other older loved ones, like what to do if you're worried about falls or safety or memory or even the quality of an older person's healthcare. I'm your host, Dr. Leslie Kernison. I'm a practicing geriatrician, so that means I'm a medical doctor specialized in geriatrics, which is the art and science of modifying healthcare so that it works better for older people and for their families. In today's episode, I'm going to talk about what you should know and do about cardiovascular risk factors for better brain health and also for better heart health and overall health. And I decided to address this because last year I wrote an article on cerebral small vessel disease, which is that really common condition that is often noted on the brain MRI results of older adults. So if an older adult gets a scan of their brain, chances are that they'll see some little spots or something that is described often as ischemic small vessel disease, or there are a variety of other terms that might be used. And these are in some ways like teensy little strokes in the brain, and although they're often unnoticed by people, if you have enough of them, it tends to be associated with some pretty significant problems such as cognitive decline, so a decline in people's ability to manage their memory or thinking processes, also associated with balance problems or even vascular dementia and some other problems. And I describe this condition in greater detail in episode 48 and in the related article. So I wrote this article not even a year ago, and it quickly generated lots and lots of comments from readers and visitors to Better Health While Aging. And one of the most frequent questions was this: my MRI shows signs of this condition. What can I do? So as I explained in the original article, and in my replies to people's questions in the comments, the first thing to do is always to work closely with your doctors to ask them what is the likely cause of this damage to the brain's small vessels, because there are a variety of things that could cause this damage and those MRI findings. But the thing is that in the end, what's thought to be the underlying cause of a lot of this damage is thought to be atherosclerosis affecting the smaller arteries of the brain. Now, I'm going to explain the term atherosclerosis in greater detail in a moment, but it basically means diseased blood vessels. And this is such a common condition in people. It happens to blood vessels as people get older. We're going to talk a little bit more about why this happens in this episode, but in a way, it's very mundane and ordinary. And that's probably part of the reason why doctors don't bring up the MRI finding necessarily to their patients unless they're asked. And it's probably also why if you ask your doctor, what should I do about, you know, these changes that are showing up on the MRI, they might well shrug and kind of wave it off, because the things that you're supposed to do are kind of the general things that are recommended for the health of blood vessels. So in many cases, asking the doctor why you have signs of cerebral small vessel disease is a little bit like asking why you have high blood pressure or arthritis, which is not at all a related condition, but is similar in that these are common conditions in older adults. They're usually due to medically mundane causes and risk factors, including suboptimal quote-unquote lifestyle behaviors. We'll talk more about those in a moment. And also associated with the general, quote, wear and tear that the body experiences as one gets older with years and years. Now, it's true that in some people, damage to the small vessels in the brain may be related to one or more particular medical conditions that they have. And younger people in particular, I would say, are more likely to have a particular condition that would be driving those changes. But in older adults, it's usually thought to be multifactorial, so due to multiple things happening. And the usual advice, if there are signs of cerebral small vessel disease, is to evaluate and address cardiovascular risk factors. So this is what I kept repeating in the comments, but I got the feeling that even though I had briefly explained what would be involved in the article, that it might be helpful to go into this into more depth. So I recently wrote an article on this topic, which I will link to in the show notes, and I'm also doing this podcast episode on the topic. In this episode, we're going to talk about cardiovascular risk factors and what you should know and do about them, whether you're concerned about brain health or blood vessel health more broadly. We call it cardiovascular because historically it was thought to be so deeply involved with the heart, but of course blood vessels go throughout the entire body and play a crucial role in bringing oxygen and nutrients to every cell in your body. And your brain actually uses up 20% of your oxygen, so the blood vessels that go to the brain are very, very important. Generally, what's good for the blood vessels going to the heart is also good for the blood vessels going to the brain. So the specific things that I'm going to cover in this podcast episode is, first, I'm going to talk a little bit more about how you can understand cardiovascular risk factors. Specifically, I'm going to cover three key ways that blood vessels become damaged in the human body. I'm going to explain what is atherosclerosis for those who may not be sure or might benefit from a refresher. And I'm also going to explain why certain chronic health conditions are considered vascular risk factors or cardiovascular risk factors. I'm also going to briefly review what is the number one risk factor for future cardiovascular events. It's important to be aware of this because if this has happened to you or someone you know, then it's even more important to identify and address any cardiovascular risk factors that you might have. And then I have a list of 12 key cardiovascular risk factors that I'll share with you. And then in the end, I'm going to cover five key approaches that I think every older adult should use to improve cardiovascular health. They're the sort of five approaches that I think are the most high yield and beneficial. And I think that's where most people should start off concentrating. So now let's talk about cardiovascular risk factors, and I'm going to start with three key ways that blood vessels become damaged. And I wanted to start with this because I feel like it can be helpful to sort of understand the greater principles of what helps something in the body work well or work less well in order to then understand sort of specific risk factors or conditions. So let me tell you about three key ways that blood vessels become damaged. Generally, what's bad for blood vessels will fall into one of the following three categories. One is that it's a form of inflammation. Now, inflammation is a topic on which I should probably do a podcast episode in of itself, but inflammation basically means that aspects of the body's immune system are revved up. So the immune system is the system in your body, including white blood cells and certain proteins that help you fight off infection. And so when the immune system gets revved up, it does help fight infection, but the immune system sometimes remains highly activated long term. And this actually creates a fair amount of wear and tear on cells in the body. And if it's pronounced or if it's directed at a specific kind of organ or cell in the body, this can also cause autoimmune disease. So there are lots of things that we are exposed to in life that can increase inflammation levels in the body. And when we have generally high levels of inflammation in the body, this does cause the blood vessels of the body to build up plaque. How do we know if a person is experiencing high levels of inflammation? There are different ways to assess this, but one common one is having higher levels of certain proteins that are associated with inflammation, such as C-reactive protein, or sometimes we also look for the increased presence of certain types of blood cells. You should know that many health conditions, not just the autoimmune diseases, are associated with chronic inflammation. So for instance, research shows that obesity is actually associated with a certain kind of chronic low-level inflammation in the body, and even aging is associated with a chronic form of low-level inflammation, and this phenomenon has sometimes been called inflammaging. So if you want to learn more about inflammation, I have some links in the related article, and I'll also try to put something in the show notes. But basically, chronic low-level inflammation in the body does usually cause the blood vessels to develop a form of chronic irritation, and this can promote plaque, which is the sort of development of buildup on the inside of blood vessels. Another thing that tends to be bad for your body's blood vessels is forms of mechanical stress. So this means physical forces, such as high blood pressure, that create wear and tear on blood vessels. And high blood pressure is probably the main form of this type of mechanical stress. And then another thing that's bad for blood vessels, no matter what size they are, is experiencing a form of mechanical obstruction. So this means anything that is kind of blocking the inside of the blood vessel. So in a way, you can think of your blood vessels as tubes or pipes that are going through the body that need to be able to have blood and other substances flow through them. So when they develop buildup on the inside, then the flow going through is impaired or limited, and that's not great for the body. So first of all, the flow is slower, and certain parts of the body can suffer from not having as much flow through the vessels or, you know, as fast a rate of flow. But also another problem is that sometimes when buildup happens on the inside of blood vessels, and this kind of buildup is often called plaque, pieces of the plaque can break off and then go and block off a downstream narrower part of the blood vessel. That's actually one of the classic ways that people experience a certain type of heart attack, is that it's not just that the arteries around their heart, which bring the blood to their heart, are becoming blocked up a little bit. And so the flow is not as good. And so that means they might experience some chest pain when they exert themselves and when they need that extra blood flow to the heart. But also a piece of plaque can break off from the artery and move further down to where the artery is getting narrower and narrower, because that's kind of the nature of arteries. They keep getting narrower as they get deeper into the body's tissues or organs, and it can create a total blockage. And when blood flow to cells is totally cut off, cells start to die within minutes, whether they're brain cells or heart muscle cells or other parts of the body can also sometimes experience a sudden blockage of blood flow, which can be extremely damaging. So those are basically the three things that I think about when I think of damage to blood vessels: is chronic inflammation, mechanical stress, which is, you know, mostly the pressure of high blood pressure over time, and then getting obstructed on the inside, either chronically developing buildup or maybe developing a sudden plugging up due to a piece of plaque breaking off from upstream or a clot coming from somewhere else. And so later when I go through the 12 risk factors, you'll see that many of them fall into one of those three categories. And some of them, you know, can be considered as falling into more than one category at the same time. So next, before we go into the 12 specific risk factors, what is atherosclerosis? Now, you may already be familiar with the term, but in case you're not, it's an important term to be aware of, whether you're concerned about heart health or brain health or otherwise blood vessel health. So atherosclerosis, and there's a related term, arteriosclerosis, means the process of artery walls becoming inflamed and then thickened by plaques and then hardened. So calcium often gets deposited into the blood vessel wall during the process of atherosclerosis. And so this contributes to the blood vessel becoming stiffened, which actually usually means that, one, that causes higher blood pressure, and two, that might make the vessel less resilient. And then the vessel can also become calcified. And so you may have heard of how they sometimes do scans to check for calcium in blood vessels, and that's what that's referring to. This is a process that takes years and years, and it's very much influenced by what we would call lifestyle factors, like the level of obesity of the person, the kinds of foods that they're eating, whether they're physically active or not. And atherosclerosis tends to develop in people's blood vessels at some point, for most people, probably in young adulthood, and slowly get worse as they get older and older. Now, unfortunately, you know, they're starting to find it in children, especially the ones who are overweight or eat a very bad diet. And then there are a couple exceptionally healthy people who might develop it later. And instead of in their 20s, they might not really show signs of it until later. And when I say signs, I mean signs if you actually look at the blood vessel. There are not so many people who are experiencing symptoms from their atherosclerosis in their 20s. In short, atherosclerosis is the most common way that blood vessels become slowly damaged and obstructed over time, and this process happens in large part due to chronic exposure to inflammation and mechanical stress from high blood pressure. And so just as it affects the blood vessels that go to the heart, the coronary arteries, it also affects the blood vessels that go into the brain, whether they're the sort of larger ones. The carotids are the ones in the neck that, you know, are sometimes scanned as well, but also affects the even smaller ones that are in the brain and really can affect all blood vessels throughout the body, all arteries throughout the body. So just as a reminder, arteries are the blood vessels that are carrying oxygen-rich blood from the heart to the cells, and they tend to have higher pressure inside them, whereas veins are the blood vessels that carry blood that has already given up its oxygen, and they're under much lower pressure. So although you can develop diseases in the veins, they're usually very different in type, in large part because the veins aren't experiencing as much pressure inside. So the last general concept that I wanted to cover briefly is the way that some chronic health conditions are considered cardiovascular risk factors. So as health professionals, when we think about cardiovascular risk factors, we think not only about a condition such as high blood pressure, which, as I was saying, you know, creates mechanical stress on the blood vessels, and that creates, you know, slow damage and wear and tear, but we also actually consider certain health conditions. And that's because, as I mentioned, some of them cause inflammation or other stress on the blood vessels. Lots and lots of diseases fall into this category. Not only the autoimmune diseases, but also things like diabetes, obesity to a certain extent. And then one might also consider mental health conditions as causing inflammation and stress on blood vessels. And that's because we know that certain conditions, such as depression or anxiety, can be associated with increased levels of stress hormones or other inflammatory products in the body. And so it's hypothesized that that creates a certain strain on blood vessels as well. And that might be part of the reason that we find that those conditions are associated with a higher chance of experiencing either cardiovascular disease or an actual event such as a heart attack or stroke. So that's one type of health condition that could be considered a cardiovascular risk factor are the ones that are known to cause inflammation or stress on blood vessels. The other category of health condition that's often considered a cardiovascular risk factor would be conditions that are themselves often caused or related to damage to blood vessels. Probably the most important one and common one to mention is chronic kidney disease. So the kidneys have to process all the blood in your body several times a day. And so when they start working less well, and that's what chronic kidney disease means, it means that they are filtering significantly less blood, or they're filtering it more slowly and less efficiently than they used to. So when people develop chronic kidney disease, so it's developed over time and it's permanent, that is usually related in some way to blood vessel health. So it's often related to having had pretty bad high blood pressure for years and years, or diabetes for years and years. Okay, so now before I go into the 12 key cardiovascular risk factors that I wanted to tell you about, I just want to highlight the number one risk factor for future cardiovascular events. It's not on the list of 12. It kind of gets its own separate calling out, but it's important and you should know about it. For most people, the top risk factor for having a cardiovascular event in the future, and again, in healthcare, we define having a cardiovascular event as having something like a heart attack or a stroke, a kind of very noticeable acute event that is related to a malfunction in your blood vessels. So the number one risk factor is having had one of these in the past. So it's having had a heart attack or a stroke or possibly a transient ischemic attack, which means you get the symptoms of a full-on stroke, but they don't last for more than 24 hours. That's called having established cardiovascular disease. It's also sometimes called having clinical atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, big term. So again, it means somebody has already experienced a health event or a condition related to the atherosclerosis. And that's really important because almost everybody has atherosclerosis, but once people actually have an event, they've kind of kicked themselves into a whole higher level of risk. Another thing that will qualify you as having established cardiovascular disease is if you develop symptomatic, what's called peripheral artery disease, which happens when large arteries bringing blood to the limbs or sometimes to certain organs develop blockages that are significant enough to cause symptoms. Having established cardiovascular disease matters to us as health professionals because we usually have different guidelines for how to manage cardiovascular risk factors in people who have already had an event. This is called secondary prevention. So once somebody has had the crisis or event and you want to prevent it from happening again, that is called secondary prevention. Whereas when we're trying to prevent the first heart attack or stroke or the first cardiovascular event, that is called primary prevention. So to come back to the question of cerebral small vessel disease, does it matter if you've had a history of stroke or heart attack? Well, the research suggests that it does, and several studies have found that having a history of stroke or heart attack is associated with more signs of cerebral small vessel disease on MRI. And I think that gets back to this idea that what's bad for blood vessels is bad for blood vessels and will increase the chance of experiencing a sign of a sort of big blood vessel event or bigger blood vessel event, such as a heart attack or stroke. But those things are also causing damage to the teeny tiny blood vessels in the brain and elsewhere, and that can have consequences for an older person's health and well-being. So now that we've covered the broader categories of what affects blood vessel health, let me finally share with you my list of the most common and important specific risk factors. So if you've been worried about cerebral small vessel disease, these are probably the risk factors that you'll want to be discussing with your doctor. In no particular order, they are number one, high blood pressure. Number two, high cholesterol, especially having a high level of what is called LDL, low density lipoprotein cholesterol. That's also sometimes referred to as the quote unquote bad cholesterol. Number three is having problems managing blood sugar. So that would include having a diagnosis of diabetes, type 1 or type 2. For older adults, it's usually type 2. Or having a diagnosis of prediabetes, having signs of what we call insulin resistance, or signs of a decreased ability to manage one's blood sugar effectively. So number 4 would be chronic kidney disease, defined as having a filtration rate of less than 60 milliliters per minute. For reference, normal would usually be 90 to 120 milliliters per minute. So healthier kidneys can filter more milliliters of blood per minute. Number 5 is obesity. Number 6 is cigarette smoking. Number 7 is high levels of inflammation as measured by the inflammatory marker C-reactive protein or as measured by other tests. Number 8 is obstructive sleep apnea. Number 9 is psychological stressors, including depression, anger, anxiety, and stress. Number 10 is insufficient exercise. Number 11 is dietary factors, which include 1, having diets with a high glycemic index or load. So that means eating things that tend to make your blood sugar spike up. Another factor would be not eating enough fruits and vegetables. Another factor would be not eating enough dietary fiber. And another factor would be eating a lot of red meat, processed meat, and or high fat dairy products. So those are all dietary factors that have been associated with an increased risk of having cardiovascular disease. And then the 12th risk factor is age and gender, which I combined together. So that's the short list. Now, of course, you're probably wondering, well, how does one define each of these? I mean, what counts as high blood pressure? What counts as too high blood pressure? What should your blood pressure be to be managing your cardiovascular risks or reducing your cardiovascular risks? What does it mean to sort of not exercise enough, and how much exercise is enough? What exactly should one be eating, and so on and so forth? This is where things get a little tricky, because basically almost all of these risk factors can be thought of as a risk spectrum, where one side, you know, the sort of higher or worse it gets, the more cardiovascular risk, and the other side has less risk. So, you know, with blood pressure, we know that generally the higher your blood pressure, the higher your cardiovascular risk. Now, for some factors, if you go too far on the other side, you can have blood pressure that is probably too low, and that might be associated with risks as well. But generally for each of those factors, you know, there's kind of a spectrum where one side is worse. So, you know, for weight, the more and more obese you are, generally the higher the cardiovascular risk. But where exactly to place that cutoff where we say, well, this is the disease. Above this level means you have high blood pressure or obesity or a meaningfully increased risk of cardiovascular disease. Where to place those cutoffs tends to be hotly debated by experts. And similarly, there's often a lot of debate as to what is, you know, the optimal range that some factor like blood pressure or cholesterol should be in, or, you know, what is the optimal intake or amount that you should be getting when it comes to diet or exercise. So I think it's important to be aware of those factors. And when I wrote the article, I thought I can't go into the back and forth and nitty gritty about each and every one. There's a lot of research. There's a lot of back and forth about many of them. And also for each individual person, you know, it kind of depends on what else is going on with your health. And so, you know, one thing that I have addressed often on the website and sometimes on the podcast is how to figure out what's the right blood pressure goal if you're being treated for high blood pressure for an older person. I mean, there are a lot of factors that go into it. So I can't tell you exactly in detail, you know, what the cutoff should be or what your level should be. But what I've done is that in the related article for this episode, I do share the list in a more detailed format where for each one of those factors, I explain sort of which end is usually worse in terms of cardiovascular risk. And I share some links to related research studies and guidelines when appropriate. So if you want to learn more about any of those factors, I would recommend going to the article and taking a look at the section for the particular factor that you're interested in. And now let me move on to the last section that I wanted to cover in the episode, which is my 5 top recommended way to address these factors. So how should you manage cardiovascular risk factors for better brain health? So again, if you've become concerned because brain scans are showing signs of cerebral small vessel disease, the first step should be to talk to your healthcare providers and ask them what they think are the most likely causes of the brain changes that are visible on the scans. Now, no matter what they say, you'll probably still want to review and address cardiovascular risk factors. There is a possible exception to this, which is this. It may not be worthwhile to review cardiovascular risk factors and try to optimize them if an older person has become quite debilitated or if they seem to have limited life expectancy because of an advanced condition such as advanced dementia or advanced heart failure or advanced lung disease or cancer. So if for whatever reason, it seems like the goals of medical care are now more about prioritizing comfort and function rather than longevity, then it might not make sense to really focus on optimizing these cardiovascular risk factors. And again, I addressed the idea of goals of care in episode 54. Let's assume that you or the person you're concerned about are not terribly frail or debilitated, and so it makes sense to address cardiovascular risk factors. How should you do this? So you might think that one answer is to work away and evaluate and treat each one of those factors. That's not necessarily a bad idea, but it can be very labor intensive. And it also sort of carries the risk of what I think of as falling down the rabbit hole, where you start to look into the exact right way to manage cholesterol. And there are just infinite research articles. There are infinite articles written by other health and wellness experts on the web. And you can just spend a lot of time trying to hash out the details. And that can be worth doing. But before you do it, I really recommend sort of taking an approach that I think is a foundational for us in geriatrics, where we really think about the forest before getting too deep into the trees. And before we go and get extremely focused on tinkering with any particular tree or condition or physical parameter of the person, we start off by thinking, you know, what helps the person and their health overall? And when you think of it that way, there are actually these 5 approaches that are quite foundational and high yield and likely to lead to better cardiovascular health and also better health in other ways. So let me share those with you. Now, these, for the most part, are probably not going to be surprising, but I think it's important to just bring them up and encourage you to consider them again. The first is to avoid tobacco smoke. So if you're a smoker, stopping is one of the most powerful ways to reduce inflammation in your blood vessels. So you want to get help quitting smoking. If you live with a smoker, see if you can persuade that person to stop for their own health and for yours. And this isn't just helpful in terms of lowering your risk for cardiovascular disease or for cancer. When people quit smoking, their lung function starts to improve within days, and they often actually start feeling better in terms of their breathing as they walk around or exert themselves fairly quickly. If you're interested in resources on helping older adults quit, I have a link, Quitting Smoking for Older Adults. So that's suggestion number one. Number two, more exercise. Now, I'm sure you have heard this before, but it's true. Exercise is just good in so many ways. For people, there are some older adults, probably many, who are getting a lot of exercise, who are getting enough exercise, who are even getting the four types of exercise that we generally recommend for older people. So that would be aerobic exercise or something that sort of works your endurance, strength exercises that help build up and maintain the strength in your body's muscles, balance exercises, things that challenge your balance because that helps maintain and improve the whole system of reflexes and coordination in your body. And that's super important for preventing falls. And then flexibility, because the nature of the body is to become less flexible unless one purposefully stretches it and helps maintain flexibility. And flexibility exercises also probably help maintain mobility and reduce falls. If you're already getting plenty of exercise and the recommended amount in terms of something that's mildly aerobic is 150 minutes per week of moderate exercise. So that would be 30 minutes five times a week, or 75 minutes per week of more vigorous exercise. So something that really kind of makes you pant or sweat. So most older adults are not getting that amount of exercise. So we often tell people, well, you know, exercise or get more exercise. What does that actually mean? I think that what's best, if you're concerned about cardiovascular risk factors or any other aspect of your health, is to start by assessing one's current level of exercise and then making an effort at first to modestly increase the weekly exercise. So one little tool that's really helpful is a step tracker. So you can either get one of those new little bracelets like a Fitbit or something like that that will count your steps. There are even old-fashioned pedometers you can get. Or for people who are carrying a smartphone and usually have it in their pocket or on their person, I don't do that, but my husband does. The smartphone itself often has an integrated step counter and can estimate your steps. So I think a good start is to start off by seeing how many steps you're taking every day and then aim to increase that. Research has shown that walking at least 6,000 steps a day is associated with less arthritis. Another kind of guideline often is to aim for 10,000 steps a day, but I think really, you know, start by figuring out where you are and then ask yourself, you know, how can I do a little bit more? So for many older adults, just walking more is a good goal from a cardiovascular health perspective. As I've mentioned in other podcast episodes and on the site, walking more in of itself is probably not enough for fall prevention, but it's still an excellent activity and I highly recommend it. And then especially for older adults who are sedentary, it can be really helpful to enroll in some kind of program, you know, to give a little structure and also a social environment for the exercising. Now, when I talk to older adults, I find that often a reason that they cite that they're not getting more exercise is that they're experiencing some kind of symptom or something troublesome that's interfering. So they're experiencing pain or shortness of breath or falls. So if that's the case, you want to get help with that. Bring it up to your health providers and ask for help. So for more on exercising in later life, I'll share a link. The National Institute on Aging has a nice website called Go for Life. So I know you've already heard it, but if you're worried about cerebral small vessel disease or other aspects of your blood vessel health, more exercise will almost certainly help. And by the way, exercising has been shown to improve many of those risk factors, those 12 risk factors, can help lower in some cases blood pressure or cholesterol, certainly can help manage blood sugar. So these five approaches I'm sharing right here often help improve many of those specific risk factors that people worry about. Third recommendation that can exert a positive influence on many cardiovascular risk factors is to eat a, quote, healthier diet. Now, I haven't written a lot about nutrition on Better Health While Aging, in part because I feel like it's this minefield and people can have very, you know, strong opinions about exactly what should or shouldn't be included. So I want to go over just some general principles here. You can debate the exact components of a healthy diet or any particular, you know, nutrient or supplement, but the general principles, as articulated by the writer Michael Pollan, are pretty sound, which is eat real food, not too much, mostly plants. And I have looked over some of the research these past few years and read some books on the topic. And what I think is most important, in part based on the study of the Mediterranean diet, which I wrote about on the site, and I'll share a link to it in the show notes, are the following goals. You know, one, eat lots of vegetables, greens, fruits, whole grains, beans, and lentils. It's important to eat a lot of them, and it's important to eat a variety. So for instance, for vegetables, you want to eat leafy greens and also the colored ones, carrots, beets, red cabbage, and also what's known as, you know, the cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, cauliflower, the such. You want to eat lots of varied fruits, and then beans and lentils generally seem to be very beneficial. So why are these foods so beneficial? Well, they provide crucial fiber, vitamins, and minerals to the body. And what research over the past 10 to 20 years has shown is that they're really important to the composition of your gut's microbiome. So that's the population of bacteria that live in every person's bowels. When I was in medical school, we weren't taught much about it. You know, there's lots of bacteria in there, and it was thought that they weren't doing much. But the research over the past 20 years has found that they're actually really important, that they are constantly influencing your immune system and also the sort of production of inflammatory substances in the body. They might be, it's quite plausible that they're part of the way that diet affects cardiovascular health, actually, is not so much that meats or things, you know, get directly into your bloodstream, but that they affect the kind of bacteria that you have in your gut and the kind of products that those bacteria create and that influence your health. So how exactly to sort of have the healthiest microbiome is a little bit under debate, but it does seem that, you know, more fiber is good, more fruits and vegetables, very good, beans, lentils, very, very important. That's probably the most important aspect of eating a healthier diet, is just eating more of that non-processed plant food. And then also you want to think about minimizing added sugars. There is a fair amount of research suggesting that a lot of added sugars is not so good for one's health and probably promotes weight gain as well. You want to minimize fast food and processed foods, including processed meats. And then you want to consider minimizing simple starches, so refined flours and most sweets, especially if your blood work suggests problems managing blood sugar. Now, you should know that research indicates that a person's response to diet is highly individual. In researching this article and podcast episode, I read about a very interesting Israeli study that was published in 2015, where they were interested in people's glucose level after eating a meal. That's called the post-meal glucose or postprandial glycemia. And having a higher level of blood sugar after the meal has been associated with a higher risk of diabetes and also with higher levels of inflammation, with worse cardiovascular outcomes. So they were interested in following that. And what they did is that they continuously monitored people's blood sugar for a certain period of time. And they had like 800 people, and they measured their response to thousands of different meals. And sometimes they would give everybody the exact same meal and see how people responded. And what they found was that it was extremely variable the way people responded, people's bodies responded to a meal. And so it wasn't the food that people took in so much that predicted the blood sugar response, but they found that it was more related to their microbiome and certain other personal factors. In short, part of this process, if you really want to use diet to optimize your health, has to be figuring out what works for you as an individual. So for one person, it might be avoiding gluten or all white flour. And for you, that may or may not be the case. And so keep that in mind when you read about very specific recommendations to include or exclude certain foods or to eat them in a certain way. Again, I think it's most useful to sort of notice the general principles that keep coming up over and over again than it is to pursue some one very specific approach unless you've tested it and confirmed that it works well for your particular body. A few other types of foods that research suggests are beneficial to older adults are nuts and seeds, especially flaxseed. Foods containing a plant substance that's called polyphenols, which includes olive oil and berries. It's a certain type of antioxidant. Cocoa and tea also have a promising track record. So dark chocolate that contains a lot of cocoa. And then fish, especially oily fish. There has been a lot of interest in omega-3 fatty acids and in taking them as supplements. The track record of supplements in of themselves when they're in a randomized trial is actually not that impressive. So it's been hypothesized that maybe it's fish itself that is more beneficial than the actual supplement. And that issue of the randomized trial actually gets at a lot of nutrition research. I mean, basically, there are lots of studies where when they observe people, they find that eating this or that is associated with better health. But when they actually take a group and randomize them, where they, you know, randomly pick half of them to take some kind of nutrient or substance and the other half no, the results tend to be less impressive. Now, an exception to that is the PREDIMED trial. That was the randomized trial of the Mediterranean diet in Spain that was published a few years ago. And I wrote an article about that for Better Health While Aging. I'll put a link in the show notes. But in that case, and I forget how many years they followed people, but they did see fewer cardiovascular events in people who were randomized to the Mediterranean diet. And it was an effect kind of on order with taking, you know, a statin drug to improve your cholesterol. So I think the overall principles of the Mediterranean diet are sound, and it's probably better to focus on changing the foods you eat and less on finding the exact right supplement to take. Let me move on to my fourth general suggestion. The fourth one is to seek out and maintain social connections and purpose. And I mentioned this in the previous podcast episode, the episode just before this one, when I was talking about, you know, my sort of top 10 recommendations for better health while aging. But I'll mention it again here. I think it's sometimes underrated, and people are focused on their health and they're very focused on tinkering with all these things with their doctors. But don't forget, there is a lot of evidence that the quality of our social relationships and our feeling of purpose and of being connected to the world around us are hugely important in helping older adults feel their best and are associated with better health outcomes and maintaining independence and the ability to do things. So, for those older adults who feel lonely or feel they have few social connections, or maybe just feel like they don't have enough purpose or don't feel connected enough to their communities around them, there are a lot of options. And as physicians and health providers, we don't always pay enough attention to helping people identify these, but it's actually really important for health. So, you know, options include making an effort to reconnect or improve connections with families and friends, seeking work, volunteering opportunities, signing up for an exercise class, an educational activity, or another activity, whether it's designed for older adults or for the general public, participating in activities at, you know, the local center for older adults in your community, considering relocating where you live to a more supportive community or environment, especially for those older adults who find that they're often physically isolated because of transportation issues or because their home is far from activities. Can also join a support group. You can identify a cause or project to work on or participate in the local church or spiritual community. Now, for many older adults, it turns out that there seem to be physical or mental health symptoms that are interfering with their ability or motivation to participate in these kinds of activities. So especially if you've noticed frequent sadness or lack of interest or enjoyment in things that used to be interesting or enjoyable, that would be really concerning for depression, should definitely be brought up to a health provider and should be evaluated. And then another reason why people sometimes aren't participating as much socially or in their communities as they otherwise would is because they've actually been developing some memory or thinking problems. So there too, that's a red flag and requires further evaluation from a qualified health professional. If you haven't seen signs of those medical red flags, then again, in the article, I have links to some resources to help older adults address loneliness or other aspects of social isolation. And doing this probably will improve certain aspects of cardiovascular health, so I highly recommend it. And now let me get to my fifth big picture recommendation for addressing cardiovascular risk factors in a way that is healthy and beneficial overall. And this is perhaps the one that you'll have heard about the least when it comes to healthy living recommendations for older people. And that's this: it's to use non-drug methods to manage stress, anxiety, and insomnia. So if you've been following the podcast or the website, you'll know that geriatricians love to hate the sedatives and other medications that are often used for anxiety, stress, or insomnia. Because they're often risky for older people, they can diminish brain function and they worsen balance and are often associated with falls. But there's another reason to pursue non-drug methods to address these problems. And that's because those non-drug methods often are beneficial, not just for those specific problems, but for health overall. So basically, we're talking about non-drug ways to manage one's mind and mental state. And I'm going to go over a few of them right now. It's often a good idea to use them in combination. And if you have any doubts about whether they might be helpful for you, a clinician or another expert can help you determine what's most likely to help with whatever might be weighing on your mind or spirits. So probably the number one method I recommend people consider for anxiety or insomnia is something called cognitive behavioral therapy. So that's a specific type of psychotherapy that has a great track record when it comes to treating insomnia. In fact, they even have created online programs of cognitive behavioral therapy, we call it CBT, for insomnia that have been shown to be effective. It's also effective for anxiety, for worrying, for coping with stress, can be used for coping with certain kinds of stressful situations, such as a stressful caregiving situation. And the thing is, often when people come to their doctor with stress or insomnia, they're actually prescribed a pill rather than this kind of therapy. But that's a shame, because this kind of therapy helps you sort of rewire the way your brain responds to the situation. And that just pays off indefinitely and also sort of treats the condition, so can result in an improvement in your cardiovascular risk factors. So that's probably the top recommendation. But other things that can also help manage these kinds of challenges, stress, anxiety, insomnia, or certain other forms of mental and emotional distress, include mindfulness-based stress reduction, exercise, relaxation therapies, spiritual practices, activities that increase social connection and purpose, right? Various forms of meditation, spending more time outside and in nature, musical activities, programs that provide skills training and support, especially if one's stress is related to a particular kind of challenge. So again, such as, you know, caregiving or managing a chronic illness or another specific type of life challenge. And then there are lots of other forms of psychotherapy that could help. Now, for those older adults who are concerned about their sleep or experiencing insomnia, it is important to first be properly evaluated for underlying medical problems, because that's a common cause of sleep problems in older adults. And I'll post a link in the show notes to an article that I have on the top causes of sleep problems in aging. But once those kinds of medical problems have been ruled out, it's often appropriate to use these types of non-drug methods to improve one's sleep or other aspects of one's mental and emotional health. So my bottom line on managing cardiovascular risk factors for better brain health: basically, if you're concerned about cerebral small vessel disease or some other aspect of cardiovascular health, you should definitely talk to your doctor. You should definitely ask about managing your cardiovascular risk factors. I think that list of 12 cardiovascular risk factors that I shared is useful, and you should be aware of which of them are an issue for you or for the person you're concerned about. But then as you try to address them, remember that these five, you know, most of them are essentially healthy living basics, are really important and should not be underestimated. So again, don't smoke, get plenty of exercise, and if you're not getting enough, just try to get a little bit more. That's a good start. Eat a healthier diet, seek out and maintain social connections and purpose, and then really think about investing the time and effort into pursuing non-drug methods to manage stress, anxiety, insomnia, or life challenges. Most people have heard of these five, but in my experience, not that many people are really working on them. And that's a shame, because they bring on lots of bonus benefits beyond cardiovascular health. They just help maintain the health and well-being and independence of older adults in so many ways. And they're safer than relying on drugs because they don't interact with other things. They're less likely to cause risks or harm to health. So as I was saying, as geriatricians, we try to see and care for the forest before getting too focused on the trees. So those five approaches are ways to really nurture the underlying soil of your health. And that's not to say that there's not a role for tests and medications. Lots of my own patients do take prescription medications, but you always want to make sure that you've addressed these holistic lifestyle approaches as well, because that's what's usually best and most effective for the brain, the heart, and the aging body. And with that, I'm going to wrap up this episode of Better Health While Aging. If you have any questions about something you heard in this episode, you can post it on the show notes page for the episode. I'll also be posting some links to some of the resources that I mentioned in the episode. To find the show notes, visit betterhealthwhileaging.net and click podcast in the main menu at the top. Last but not least, if you've been enjoying the podcast, don't forget to support us by subscribing on iTunes. And if you've already done that, please leave a rating and review. This makes it easier for others to discover our show in iTunes, and I would love for the many people who are interested in health or aging or family caregivers to be able to find it and give it a chance. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Dr. Leslie Kernison, and I'm looking forward to you joining us for future episodes.